Yes.
My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic.
I'm
a member of the Carl Gables group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege to be here. I haven't found necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink since January 25th, 1981. And for that, I'm grateful. And this is the second meeting in a series on the steps. This might have something to do with step two. Maybe not. We'll see how that works out. And I want to read a couple things in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you guys a couple of stories. It's a wonderful day. I start off the day every Thursday morning. I had to go to a men's Bible study at 7:30 in the morning. I buy the bagels. You're all invited, the men. And we start off by singing a song called I Love to Tell the Story. And off key, probably. And tonight I'm going to tell a little bit about my story. Because it's our stories that disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. And the real power of this deal is really in our stories. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that deal. They wanted me to do my talk on humility. I never do it with a group this small. But okay. Page 29. Listen up, page 29. Further on, clear-cut directions are given showing how we recovered. These are followed by 42 personal experiences. Each individual in the personal stories describes in his own language and from his own point of view the way he established his relationship with God. In Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, that's the man on the bed. We talked a little bit about him last time, but if you go a little bit past that story, there is a story that is called He Sold Himself Short. And you might want to take a look at this story one of these days. I want to read the last three or four paragraphs of this story by one of the individuals in Alcoholics Anonymous, the early pioneers. This is on page 266. These last 18 years have been the happiest of my life, trite though that statement may seem. 15 of those years I would not have enjoyed had I continued drinking. Doctors told me before I stopped that I had only 3 years at the outside to live. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old impatient chomping at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish the little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks that are an integral part of living fully. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people, where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair-weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am, and over my AA years, I have made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish. I'm rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods is not great, but I have a fortune in friendships, in courage, in self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, I have gained the greatest thing, accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust where I have been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can. That's his story. That's part of his story. In the chapter, There Is a Solution, the first 100 wrote the following. We, on page 25, in expressing their experience and what the program had done for them, the transformation, says, we have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed, which I suggest to you is more than just not drinking. I've been sober, it'll be 32 years this month. I sponsored and worked with thousands of men. I've been to thousands of AA meetings. I have a lot of experience with working with alcoholic men and alcoholic women. You know, my sponsor said when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will walk away with an experience. We all have opinions, but the one thing 32 years gives me, and believe me, it's not the longest thing of time. My sponsor, my current sponsor, has 57 years. It's just a record for me. Is it gives you a little, I don't know, I guess it gives you a little insight into patterns. And you can see things maybe from a distance. You know, you've been around, you see people who stay, people who leave. And I can promise you this, that there are many, 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 many people in Alcoholics Anonymous that will stop drinking. Some will actually, very few, stay stopped. But I can promise you this, there are a fraction of those people will be rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence and experience much of heaven. When they say in the back of the book, see to it that your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass you and countless others. And then they say, you will see us in the fellowship of the Spirit. When they talk about the fellowship of the Spirit is different, I suggest, if you read the material, than the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only requirement necessary to be a member in Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. We announce it at every meeting. As a matter of fact, it used to be an honest desire to stop drinking. They removed the word honest. It was too high a bar for alcoholics. A fleeting thought, I got nothing else to do tonight, I might as well pick up a white chip, will do. But that desire to stop drinking, even a dishonest desire to stop drinking that'll get you in the doors and get you into the closed meetings, is not the same requirement as what is needed to belong to the fellowship of the Spirit that they're talking about, which actually comes from one of the letters that the Apostle Paul wrote. He talked about the fellowship of the Holy Spirit. And those individuals know about something called emotional sobriety. Bill Wilson spoke about the subject of emotional sobriety. He said the real problem with alcoholics is unhealthy dependencies. Whatever that means. And I can promise you this. Most of the conversation I'm going to have with you for the next 11 weeks is going to be about emotional sobriety. It's not going to be about drinking. I can't help you with your drinking. If you got a problem with drinking, what you got to do is you got to drink. You really need to drink. Stop fooling around. Go out there and drink. And when you're ready to stop drinking, you'll either die, go to jail, or you'll come in here and you get serious. You know, I can't, you know, the only way I know how to stop drinking is you got to want to stop drinking. You got to want to stop drinking so bad that you will stop thinking about the broads. You'll stop thinking about the guys. You'll stop thinking about the sex. You'll stop thinking about everything. You will be focused on not drinking and doing anything. You'll be ready to go to any length to stop drinking. You'll even listen to stuff that you think is crazy to stop. So I don't know anything about stopping. I know I stopped. I know I got to that jumping off place. I don't take any credit for it. I didn't do anything great or grand to deserve to stop drinking, but I know I got to that thing, and it says the great fact is just this and nothing less. On these guys that were rocketed, it says the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives, the central fact of our lives today, you know how we start the meetings? We say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It says, if you want what we have and you're ready to go to, willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready. You're not really even ready to take the steps unless you want what we have. You know what they're talking about here? They're talking about what they have. They're talking about what they have. It says, the great fact is this, nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today. You know what the central fact means? It means the central fact. You know what it says? It says the great fact is this and nothing less. That means nothing less than this. This is the great fact. That the central fact in our lives today, I guess the central fact would be something that is central to your life. What do you think? That's my suggestion. I could be wrong. I guess if something's central to your life, it would be something that you're always thinking about. You wake up in the morning thinking about it. You go to sleep at night thinking about it. All through the day you're thinking about it. You know, you can't help but thinking about it. It's just like the central fact of your lives today. It's not about money, is it? I don't think the central fact is about money. You know? Anybody here ever think about money? I don't think that's the central fact for these guys. I don't think it's about getting laid. I don't think that's what they're going to talk about here. I don't think that's a central fact. You know, I sponsor a lot of guys in AA. You know, I know what the central fact in their lives are. A lot of them. I don't think it's about whether or not you're going to lose the job or get the job or any of this other stuff that is talked about in discussion meetings. Let's see what they say. They say the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator, that a capital C, has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. They weren't even unsure. They said the absolute certainty. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. Which is the same thing that they talk about in the promises. He is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Now, if you've been around here for a while, and you're saying to yourself, you know, that does not necessarily describe my life. I mean, I haven't had a drink in a year or two. I got an email from a guy who's got 25 years in Korea. And he says, I haven't been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence. You know, I'm struggling one day at a time. I haven't experienced this thing. If you're sitting in here and you're not drinking and life is okay, but you haven't been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, and you haven't experienced much of heaven, and this thing ain't happening to you, it doesn't mean it's not going to happen to you. It doesn't mean it can't happen to you. What it does mean is it just hasn't happened for you yet. It doesn't mean it won't happen for you. If you go to Alcoholics Anonymous number 3 in the book, Bill Dotson, the man on the bed over there, when he's telling his story, he says the following. I'll give it to you in a second. This is page 191. It would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, a something I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was something more. I knew there was even more, something I hadn't got. So if you're out there and you're saying, I know there's something more, I know there's something I haven't got, you're in good company, because the guy in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3 felt the same way. As a matter of fact, I felt the same way. I knew there was something more. I knew there was something I hadn't got. And I remember one day, a week or two after I'd come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch, and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Not only a release from alcohol, but this rocket ship ride, this experience much of heaven, this release from fear. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her, Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling other people. I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing, and he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence that I heard 2 weeks out of the hospital, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep telling people about it, has been a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me, which is kind of funny because at the end, on page 164, it says, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Which is kind of interesting, because that's probably why they say in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, on page, let's find it, 63, when we sincerely took such a position that we're not God, turning our lives over to him, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all powerful. He's not a higher power, he's the highest power. He's all powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. We were reborn. We thought well before taking this step, making sure that we were ready, that we could last abandon ourselves utterly to him. When I was 18 or 19 years old, I got a few bucks from some trust fund that was left me or something. I don't know how much it was, but I think about $8,000 or something. Back then, that was a lot of money. Still a lot of money today, I suppose. But for an 18 or 19 year old kid, it was a lot of money. And I suppose even before the alcohol, though I had started drinking, if I was addicted to anything, it was women. I've always been addicted to women. Ever since I saw my first Playboy magazine, I've been addicted to women. Oh yeah, you guys are laughing. You don't know what it's like. You know what I mean? You know, I think if you're an alcoholic, you know, I used to think, you know, when you're an alcoholic, one of the old ideas you have as an alcoholic is that as you are so different, you are so unique, that nobody could really understand you, nobody can talk to you. You know, that people would come up to me and say, you know, you have a drinking problem. I said, I can see where you're sitting, you think I have a drinking problem, but I think if you really knew my life and understood all the nuances of my life and everything that happened in my life, which you couldn't possibly do because I'm so unique, I'm so different, you'd understand that I don't have a drinking problem. I drink because I have problems. As a matter of fact, my drinking perfectly matches my problems, and pretty soon my problems are going to go away. I'm going to have enough money, or I'm going to get a new girlfriend, or something's going to happen, and I won't have to drink anymore. So thank you very much for your advice. Why don't you go screw yourself, you know? What I walked around the planet saying, what's the use of asking anybody to do anything, because nobody could ever understand. Now, of course, I've gotten rid of a lot of old ideas in 32 years. And I went from an individual who was 18, 19, 20, 30 years old, who knew everything. See, I'm just like you guys. I knew everything. You remember when you knew everything?
Yeah.
Before you came in here, right?
Yeah.
So, So before you came in here, you knew everything, and then you hit this brick wall. We'll call it, for lack of a better word, reality. You know, I stopped drinking when the consequences of my drinking came at me faster than my ability to lower my standards. You know, because if you're an alcoholic and you're brilliant, no matter how bad you screw up other people's lives and your lives, you can figure out, because you're so brilliant, how it's really not your fault, you're not to blame, and things aren't that bad anyway. I mean, you know, hey, the Apostle Paul was in jail, so what's wrong with being in jail? You know what I mean? You can just sort of figure out that it's not your fault. But if you're lucky, somewhere along the line, you hit that wall called reality, and you look in the mirror, or like for me, it was 3 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Eve, 1980, whatever time it was for you, and you look at me and say, who am I kidding? I need help. I can't stop drinking. You know, my life is over. I'm 31 years old. And right at that precise point in time, you go from somebody that knows everything to somebody that maybe doesn't know everything. And so there's a little window where you might actually listen to somebody. Now, the problem is, as soon as you come to AA and you pick up that white chip, after about 3 or 4 weeks, you know how we are. We walk in unemployable, and 3 months later, we're underpaid. You know what I mean? Yeah, I can't get a job. My life is for crap. If I can only get a job, then we get a job. 3 months later, we're complaining about the boss. You know, I should be running the place. They don't know anything. And you know, then all of a sudden, what happens? We become brilliant again, not drinking. Because what we discover, although we come in here because we have a drinking problem, and we come in here because we start thinking drinking is the problem, because drinking becomes the problem. We become sort of like addicted to alcohol. But of course, what the book says, and we ultimately realize after we've been here for a few months or weeks, is that drinking is really a symptom of the problem. That if you're an alcoholic, the real problem is sobriety. Because sober, we're restless, irritable, discontented, and a whole bunch of other crazy things, unless we can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And so I drank alcohol because no woman, no car, no amount of money, no anything worked quite as well and quite as fast as just a few drinks. And if it worked for me today the way it worked for me when I was 21 years old, I'd still be drinking. But of course, the problem with my life, or the good part about my life, is alcohol doesn't work for me anymore. The bad part is it stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me. You know, which is a whole other thing having to do with denial and things like that. So what happens is you come in here like a guy I sponsored, you know, Tommy, where he came in here and he stopped drinking. And 3 weeks later, he called me up and he said the following. He said, because he had been living with himself for 3 weeks. And he was great for 3 weeks. And then the day came where he went crazy. You know, the day comes, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, whatever it is, where you go crazy. Because your mind is ganging up on you. You know, you see, they don't arrest you for driving while feeling sorry for yourself. Yeah. They don't arrest you while driving while being angry or resenting. They don't arrest you, they arrest you for driving. So you think it's drinking. So the day came in his life where he realized that he was miserable. But he couldn't blame it on scotch because he hadn't had a drink in 3 weeks. So he called me up and he said, Russell, I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic. He was in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. But the day came when the program wasn't working for him because he wasn't drinking and he was feeling crappy. He was feeling sorry for himself or whatever. What does it matter? Something was going wrong. He was upset. So he said to me, he said, Russell, he says, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I said, really, Tom? He says, yeah. He says, I think I may be just crazy. And he was worried. He was worried because he was so excited to hear that he was an alcoholic, to finally learn what his problem was. Because we do come in here thinking we're different than anybody, then nobody will understand. Then we walk in and we say, they're all like me. And all of a sudden we feel like we got friends, we don't feel so alone, and now all of a sudden he's realizing he's different again. He's not an alcoholic, he's just crazy. So he called me up and he says, I think I'm just crazy. And I explained to him, I said, Tommy, you can be both. He immediately felt much better. You know, I said, yes, you can still go to the meetings. You know, I mean, this is not, by the way, guys, this is not Well People's Anonymous, if you haven't figured that out yet. So what I learned, and I didn't know this coming in to the game, but after 32 years, what I now don't know much of anything. As a matter of fact, I'm like the guys, what do they say in the last part of the book? This book, these guys were following, you know what they say the last page? They say, we know but a little. I mean, doesn't that make you feel good? The guys that wrote this book, the guys you're following, the old timers, at the end of the book, they say, we don't know crap. You're following these guys. He said, we know but a little. That's why your real reliance has to be on him, has to be on God. And so I find myself in the peculiar position of telling you that at 63 years of age, soon to be 64, I think, I'm not sure of the number, after being married 32 years, with raising four children and six grandchildren, and most of the time self-supporting through my own contribution, I have the unfortunate duty to tell you that I don't know much of anything. I know but a little, just like them. But and that's the truth, because I've lost so many old ideas that I'm idealist. I'm like the most of my ideas are gone. I've gotten rid of them. I tried to hang on to them. You know, they say, what do they say? We got to get rid of our old ideas, but the result was nil until we try to hang on. I tried to hang on to me, but they gave me nothing but grief. And they had to be wrestled from my hand. I finally had to give them up. Because every time I went with my old ideas, I'd feel sorry for myself. I'd get mad. Something bad would happen. So I had to give them up. And so now I'm left with like three ideas. I got three ideas left in my whole bag, maybe four or five, so I know nothing. But here's the deal. The few things I do know, I'm absolutely sure of. I'm absolutely certain of. And the great thing is those three or four ideas are absolutely true. And you know what I found? You can live an incredible life just knowing three or four ideas. Do you know what kind of life you can live just absolutely knowing that resentment is the number one offender? You can't even imagine. You know what? When you know that resentment is the number one offender, then even if you get a resentment, you say, this is the number one offender. You get rid of it, and then you don't have it. You know what it's like to live a life without resentments? You can't even possibly imagine. You don't realize how much resentment haunts your life and worry haunts your life until you have a day without resentment. Do you know what it's like to know that there is a God and he's watching after you, and no matter what happens, it'll all work out? It's like, you can't even possibly know what it's like to live that way. And when you live that way and you only know a few things, just a few things, the things they talk to you about in the book, what you find is you don't have to think a lot because you're not scared. And you see, if you're not scared, you don't have to control. You don't have to control people, places, and things in your mind. You don't have to yell at it, scream at it. You don't have to control anything. You don't have to control, you don't have to manipulate, and that means you don't have to worry. And I'll tell you, when you live a life without anxiety and without worry, most of the time, and none of this stuff is perfect, you'd be surprised what a rocket ship ride it is. But like I said to a guy today, he said, well, how do you do that? I said, that's a very good question. That's the deal, that's the question, isn't it? So what happens is one of the things you find out, and one of the things you start realizing from the beginning, you may not know how you do it, but you start realizing it slowly but surely, is like it says in the book, that the alcohol is just the symptom of the disease. Our disease, my disease, really lives in my mind, in my body. It's a spiritual dis-ease. And that my real problem is sobriety. For me to be sober, no matter what, it's to be basically restless, irritable, and discontented because of unhealthy dependencies and a whole lot of other things and fears. And you may not even understand this until years go down the road and you sort of see yourself and other people and do many inventories and sort of like live with yourself for a while sober and sort of get what's going on so that it's clear to you. And so all of a sudden, looking back, I see that it was clear to me, that I was addicted to women. Because I knew that if I could get a beautiful Playboy bunny to look up to me and love me, my life would be perfect. Which meant that if I could get a nice car, if I had a nice car, then I could get a Playboy bunny, because women like cars, and so I needed to, you ever say, I have to, hey girls, you ever say, I gotta have that dress. I have to have that blouse. I have to get a breast enlargement. I got to get Viagra. I got whatever it is you got to get. Yeah, whenever you say to yourself, I have to have this or I won't be happy, or I can't lose that, you know, that's the way alcoholics live. I was an if-onlier and a yes-butter. If only my life was always getting ready to be okay, it was always crap, because why wouldn't it be crap? I'm a nothing. I was always a nothing. I'm always going to be a nothing. It doesn't matter whether I have a law degree or whatever it is. I am a nothing. I used to drink scotch. You know, I used to put something in my body to turn me into an almost. When you're a nothing, almost is top of the world. And so you live your life trying to get things or put things or hook things onto yourself, whether it be a purse, a blouse, a car, whatever it is, so that you'll be okay, because the one thing you do know is you're not okay. And you go out in the world, and the entire world is a giant mirror, whether it's movies, whether it's other people, that basically tells you you're not okay. Of course, you don't tell yourself you're not okay. You tell yourself like things like, you know, I'm wonderful, I'm beautiful, I'm great, I'm chosen, I'm different, nobody understands me, they should elect me president, you know, that kind of stuff. And that it's kind of hard to hold those two thoughts in my mind. I'm a piece of shit and I'm God's gift to creation. It sets up some sort of nervousness. You know, drinking helps that, by the way. You know, but it's a tough way to live. And, of course, we tell ourselves things like, well, I don't care what other people think about me. But, you know, like Marlon Brando says, I walk into a room with 300 people. If one doesn't like me, I have to leave. Yeah. No, we don't care what other people think about us. That's why whenever we're invited to a party, we say, who's going? Who's going to be there? I mean, because if somebody's there I don't like, I can't go. Our whole life is worrying about what will they think. You know, what am I going to do? You know, we're asked to chair a meeting. We say, I'm not ready, which is another way of saying I'm scared. What if I say something stupid? And they say, you know, our whole life is about what do they think about me. So I'm 17 years old, and I got the $8,000. And, you know, here's the interesting thing. I'm my favorite fan. I never did anything in my life where I didn't think it was the best thing for me. You understand what I'm saying? Nobody likes me more than me. I was never out to sabotage me. Well, if I was never out to sabotage me, why did my life always wind up in the toilet? And the reason it always wound up in the toilet is because even though I thought I was the smartest guy in the world, the most brilliant guy in the world, I was essentially not run by my brains, I was run by my emotions and my needs. And I didn't even know what my needs were. I did crap. I don't even know why I did the crap I did. I have no idea. You know, when you bring it up to me, I say, why did I, you know, 6 months down the road, why did I do that? Why did I do that, you know? I spent more money that I didn't have on a credit card, charging things, buying stuff I didn't need to impress people I didn't like than you could possibly imagine. But every time I bought something, I mean, the only reason, nobody needs a credit card, the only reason you use a credit card is to spend money and live a lifestyle that you're not worthy to live. Because if you got the money, you take it out of your pocket and you buy the deal. And then I get to go to A rooms and complain about how I don't have any money and they're taking away my credit cards. Like, who spent the money? I went to my sponsor once, and I said, I had money problems. He says, I can solve that. I said, you can? He says, yeah, I can solve that. I said, thank God I had a sponsor. He says, yeah, you want me to solve it? He says, yeah, how do you solve it? He says, earn more or spend less. I said, well, what's option three? You know what I mean? I lived like in a dream world. So here's the deal. So I go down with the $8,000 to Tampton Chevrolet or whatever Chevrolet thing it was. And I see the brand new Camaros. It was 1971. Brand new Camaros. The sleek fastback. And I see the first one in Miami. It's in the showroom. It's got a gold exterior. And it's got a white Landau top, which we don't even have Landau tops these days. Probably the young people don't know it. It's like a vinyl top. And it was like smoking. I knew if I had that car, my life, you know, it's like I knew if I was in California. I knew if I had that car, my life would be okay. So I plunked down the money. I spent every cent I had, because saving is not in my vocabulary, you know what I mean? If I got to spend it to get that car, and I said, okay, I want to get it, because I got to have it now. Like drinking, I got to have it now. I can't wait. And he says, no, we got to prep it. No, you don't have to prep it. He says, you pay for it. The law says we got to prep it. You come back tomorrow morning at 9:30, we'll give you the car. So I was there at 8 o'clock, and I'm waiting for an hour and a half, and finally they released the car to me. It's Saturday morning at like 9:30. I get in that car, it's got like 100 miles on it, it's got the new car smell, it's like gorgeous. I drive it out of the showroom, they drive it out of the showroom floor, they drive it into the thing, I drive it into Alton Road, and I'm driving, there was no, 9:30 in the morning, Saturday morning, there was nobody on, I promise you, there was nobody on the street. I'm in that car, I thought the entire world was looking at me. I felt like I was in a stadium, the entire 2 billion people on the planet. Every woman in China was looking at me. You know what I mean? I'm okay now. I got this car now. I'm driving now. You know what I mean? I'm waiting for them to look at me. I'm like on top of the world. I come to the first light. The first light. Some guy pulls up, probably my age, you know, ready to die over the hill, you know. Life isn't fair, you know. Some guy pulls up with this good-looking Playboy bunny sitting next to him. He's driving a brand new Cadillac. I look at him. He looks at me. I look at him, he looks at me. I look at the gal. I say to myself, why can't I have a car like that? The experience lasted 3 blocks. The payments lasted 36 months. The experience was so phenomenal, having a new car, that it sent me back every year to get a new car, I had to have a new car. That's the kind of thing where you have a new car and you put a dent in the car, and you're driving around, all you're thinking about is the dent. And they tell you it'll cost $300 to fix the dent, and you don't have the $300, but you borrow it to get it fixed because you can't stand driving around in a car with a dent in it, because what will they think about you? And you know something? You know what that is? That's something called alcoholism. Because if that kind of crap, that small crap, bothers you at all, if you even think about it, no wonder that you're going to drink. Because there's a lot worse things out there than that small little sucker. And you're living a life where every dent in your life, everything that happens in your life, every breeze that's going on is driving you crazy and you're restless, irritable, discontented. Because you want something, you're just not fit for life. Because whatever insulation God gave other people to allow them to stand up to life so that they don't want to blow their brains out, I just didn't get. I guess on the assembly line, it just passed over me. So I'm driving with my sponsor, and I'm 3 weeks sober, 3 or 4 weeks sober, 5 weeks sober, and I'm, you know, you don't even realize this stuff if you're an alcoholic, because if you're an alcoholic, this is just the way you think. It's like I said last week, I used to get all crazy, and I'd say, well, that's just my personality, and he said, Russ, it's your personality that's killing you. How can it be my personality that's killing me? I'm the greatest guy in the world. I'm in love with my personality. Everybody loves my personality. He says, it's your personality that's killing you. That's why in the sixth step where it says we separate the men from the boys, it says any man who's willing to work on this deal repeatedly for his lifetime so he can grow in the image and likeness of his creator is called a man instead of a boy. Changing his personality. Changing who and what he is. A new creature. Taking that narrow road instead of the broad highway that most people go down. So I'm 3 or 4 weeks sober, 5 weeks sober, and I don't realize this stuff because, like it says in the book, my alcoholic life seems the only normal life. And what I mean by that is not so much the drinking. I'm talking about the thinking. Yeah, I get mad. Yeah, I get angry. Yeah, I feel sorry for myself. Yeah, I'm thinking about myself all the time. Yeah, I got 10,000 thoughts. They're coming at me at 50,000 miles per hour. They're all about me and other people, and they're all bad thoughts, and they make me uncomfortable. And I can't stand silence. I have to have a radio on, a TV on. I have to be texting. I have to be doing something. Anything to distract me from silence, because if there's silence, it bothers me. And I don't even know why I feel bad. I don't even think I feel bad. I don't even think about how I feel or how I feel restless, because this is the way I felt all my life. I've never felt anything else but than this is the way I feel. So I don't even think there's anything bad about it, because this is just the way. Because for 31 years, this is the way I feel. Sober. This is the way I feel sober. I got to go kill something. I got to go somewhere. I got to go to a movie. I can't just sit here. We got to do something because I'm going nuts hanging out here. So I'm driving with my sponsor. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Didn't take much for me to get a resentment. All I had to do was walk into a room and hear anybody talk. Because if you're an alcoholic, you're given the God gift of recognizing assholes, you know. I mean, I used to sit in a bar. I'd sit in a bar. Some guy would walk into the bar. I turned to my buddy. I'd say, he'd walk in with some good-looking blonde. I'd say, look at that asshole. You know what I mean? I mean, because you could spot him. You know what I mean? You spot him. You know, they're there. They're all over the place. And so the bottom line is, because that's what we do. We talk about other people behind our back. We don't realize that's part of alcoholism. We don't realize that. And so I'm sitting there. We're picking up Bobby because he sponsored me, and he sponsored a guy named Bobby. Bobby S. And I picked up a white chip I never drank again. Never drank again. At least up till now I haven't drank again. I'm not taking any credit for it. It's just the way it is. I picked up a white chip and never drank again. But Bobby, every 90 days would drink. It was 9 days or 30 days, but he would go for 30 days. You know, some people do that. They have it there. They say things like, I'm coming on that time again. The time, 30-day, 90-day time. They have like, it's like they're on a countdown, you know what I mean, to drinking. And Bob, my sponsor, would pick up, we'd go pick up Bobby from Bark or something like that. He'd dust him off, take him to the meetings, give him a new suit of clothes, give him some money, work for me. He would go, you know, help him out. And so for like the third or fourth or fifth time, I'm in Bob's car, driving to pick up Bobby, who has drank again after 30 days. And believe me, I've been taking notes because my poor sponsor, he's like stupid. He didn't really graduate. He didn't graduate high school. You know what I mean? And I know I can see he may have 15 years, but he doesn't know what he's doing. Because he's once again picking up Bobby. You understand what I'm saying? And I'm taking notes. We did this last month. We did the month before. I'm writing down every time we did this thing. You know what I mean? And, you know, this guy's taking advantage of. So I start lighting into my sponsor. I said, you know, this is crazy. We shouldn't go pick this guy up. This guy is a phony. He doesn't care. He doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about me. We did this last month. We did it the month before. He's a liar. He always says it. He's wasting your time. He's wasting your money. He doesn't care about you. He doesn't care about me. I'm a true alcoholic. You know, I mean, I'm like my own lynch mob. I'm like geeking myself up as I'm talking. And I'm pounding. And I'm a lawyer. I'm giving the greatest opening statement. I got 3x5 cards. I got photographs. I got the facts. I was right. I was so right. I was Alky right. If you disagree with me, you have to die because you're so stupid. You know what I mean? I was just right. And I kept on talking. I said, we got to stop it. You got to turn this around and forget this thing. And then, bam, you know? And then I'd say, and my sponsor looked at me and he says, are you done? And of course I wasn't, because if you're an alcoholic, you know, you start that thing going. It's like a freight train. It's like, now I'm arguing with the 15,000, with the committee in my head. You know what I mean? Because they're talking to me now about him. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, yeah, he must, you know. Yeah, he's got to be stupid if he doesn't realize you're right. You know what I mean? He says, are you done? I said, yeah. He says, no, are you done, Russell? Are you done? I said, yeah, I'm done. He says, are you done? Are you done? I said, yeah, I'm done. I'm done. I mean, what could he say? Because I was right. Do you understand what I'm saying? Trust me, I was right. He was full of shit. I was right. To this day, I can prove it to you mathematically. I was right. You got to be crazy to disagree with me. I mean, I got all sorts of degrees on the wall. You know what I mean? This guy doesn't have anything. I'm right. I'm seeing this thing clearly because I know everything. So my sponsor looks at me and he says, are you done? I said, yeah, I'm done. He says, listen. He says, I said, what? I said, listen. He says, what? He says, what? He says, Russell, are you listening? I said, yeah, what? And this is what he says to me. I don't know whether I'm 3 months, whatever months, he says, Russell, it doesn't bother me like it bothers you. How could it not bother you? Everything bothers me. But the problem was, you see, I wanted everything he had. He wanted nothing I had. 9 years later, you know what that is? That's something called alcoholism. I didn't even know I had it. I didn't even know that's what alcoholism looked like when you're sober. And I certainly didn't have any idea how to get rid of it, because it was my natural way of thinking. Blaming. 9 years later, I'm on the phone with another sponsor, because this one had died of cancer, a wonderful man. I'm on the phone with my other sponsor, and I'm complaining about my wife. Because once again, she did that thing. Whatever. I don't know what she did, but she did what she always did, what she's always done, and what she's still doing today. She spent, she talked, she disrespected, whatever it is, she did that thing that was absolutely outrageous and wrong. And so I'm on the phone for 20 minutes with my sponsor. I said, and then she did this, and I did that, and she said this, and I did that, and she said that, and I did this, and she said this, and I said that, and I go through 20 minutes of it. And I'm steamed, because I have a right to be steamed. Because I know we have a spiritual axiom, you know, whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. But let me tell you something. First of all, that doesn't include when your wife's acting like a jerk, you know what I mean? And after all, my natural way of thinking is whenever I'm disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. That's the way I naturally think. That's my old ideas. I know there's something wrong with the world. If only the world would change, if only my boss would change, if only Little River would change, then I'd be okay. What's like the odds of that? Very hard to make that happen. So I'm screaming at my sponsor about my wife and everything like that, and I finally finish, and he says this. He says, you know why you're upset? I said, what do you mean? He says, you know why you're upset? I said, what do you mean? Do I know why I'm upset? He says, do you know why you're upset? I said, well, of course I know why I'm upset. He says, well, why are you upset? I said, what do you mean, why am I upset? Well, why are you upset? I said, I just spent 20 minutes telling you exactly why I'm upset. Exactly why I'm upset. what she did this, and she said that, and I said this, and she said that, and everything. I told him exactly why I was upset. Why does God make such stupid sponsors? I'll never understand this. Stupid. And he said to me, you ready? You know what he said to me? Get this. He said, that's not why you're upset. Now listen to me. Nobody knows me better than me. I'm smarter than anybody, especially when it comes to me. And I know I'm upset. And I know why I'm upset. And I just told him why I'm upset. And he's telling me, that's not why you're upset. So I said to him, I said, that's not why I'm upset? He says, no, that's not why you're upset. That's not why I'm upset. What I just told you, that's not why I'm upset. He says, no, that's not why you're upset. What I just told you, that's you saying that's not the reason I'm upset. No, that's not the reason you're upset. And then he shut up. Well, what would you do? What would you do? I said to him, why am I upset? Because you see, if you're an alcoholic, if you're dealing with an alcoholic, you have to understand something about the alcoholic personality. You can never help an alcoholic unless he needs help, wants help, and asks for help. As soon as you volunteer an alcoholic, even the truth, they're going to tell you to go screw yourself. Even if it's the truth, they don't want to hear it because they're defiant. That's part of being an alcoholic. Whether you're drinking or not drinking, that's being defiant. It doesn't matter what you say to them. You know, they're going to say, no, go to hell. So I said, are you going to tell me why I'm upset? And he said, do you really want to know? I said, well, of course I want to know. Why am I upset? He said, listen, stupid. He said, you're upset because you're upsettable. Was it like Zen AA or something? You know, listen to me. Listen, if you understand what he was saying, he was telling me the exact same principle that my first sponsor said when he said, it doesn't bother me like it bothers you. It doesn't upset me like it upsets you. This has nothing to do with Bobby drinking. This has to do with your being upset because of something happening in your life. It doesn't bother me. The stuff that bothers you doesn't bother me. And you know, that's 9 years down the road and I hadn't figured that one out. And maybe it was another 9 years before I stopped getting upset. Now, I don't know whether my wife's changed or not. Probably not. She's probably doing the same thing. I have sponsees that hang around me, and they say things. Did you hear what your wife just said about you? I said, no. Did she say something? Did she say something? She, you know, my wife comes up to me and says, man, you're the worst husband in the world. I said, you know, I think you're right. I just plead guilty. I just want to know what the fine is. I could usually afford it. It's a blouse or something. You know, I just pay it, you know, and that's it, you know. I used to come up to my spot. I'd come up to my spot, so I complain about something, you know, the check being bounced or something like that. And, you know, he'd say, well, let me ask you something. He says, if it didn't bother you, how would you feel? What do you mean if it didn't bother me? If it didn't bother you, how would you feel? What do you mean if it didn't bother me? Yeah, if it didn't bother you. If it didn't bother me that the guy bounced the check, how would I feel? He says, yeah, if it didn't bother you. Well, if it didn't bother me, I'd feel fine. He'd say, there you go, and he'd walk away. So I go to... take a couple more. So I go to this meeting called the keynote group. There's a point here. I want to give you a point actually about the second step. You're saying, what does this have to do with the second step? This all is about the second step. You got to wait for this one. I'm just not going to hand it to you. You're going to have to wait. So I go to the keynote group. And I'm a typical young guy in AA, you know what I mean? I'm in the initial organization, the initial fellowship, the fellowship of the thumb-sucking crybabies. And I go to this meeting. I'm 3 months sober, whatever it is, 4 months sober. It's a keynote group. And a guy named Al Kennedy is chairing the meeting. He's talking like I guess I'm talking now, you know, and I'd never seen the guy before. And I was just watching this guy. I was sitting in the front row. I was watching this guy. You know, and you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm self-conscious. I'm self-centered in the extreme. I'm, you know, it says we're selfish. And I'm watching this guy, and this guy is looking at me. I mean, I'm a trial attorney. I'm trying murder cases, all sorts of cases in front of juries. I couldn't do what this guy did. This guy was like talking to hundreds of people. He looked like he knew everybody in the group, like he felt more comfortable I'd never seen anybody look more comfortable in his skin than this guy. It was like he wasn't even filtering through his mind, what do I sound like, what am I saying? He was just like talking to people. He was like so at ease, and he was like lifting people up. You know, he was obviously somebody who had a, like an inner strength, you know what I mean, about himself and knew who and what he was. You know, but he wasn't like arrogant, you know. I mean, he was loving and kind to people, but he wasn't weak. He was just, you know, he was like a man, you know. I mean, he was like somebody. I said, man, it's like one of these guys. You see these guys, you say, if I hang around this guy, it's like that guy that I read to you in the book. Remember who was it? Bill Dodson. He says, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got, and he was watching Bill Wilson. Well, I was watching my sponsors. I was watching Al Kennedy like this guy was watching Bill Wilson. I was like amazed. I was looking at these guys because I know he was an AA and I was an AA. It's like Tiger Woods, you know what I mean? I play golf and Tiger Woods plays golf. I use Titleist clubs, he uses Titleist clubs. I use the Titleist balls, he loses Titleist balls. But you want to know something? We are playing a different game. There is no doubt about it. Well, it's like I'm an AA and he's an AA. Well, we're on a different deal going. I'm sober and he's sober, but there's a different deal going on. Because I'm sober and like Tommy, I'm crazy. You know what I mean? I'm 9 years sober and I'm sober. I'm sponsoring people and I'm still crazy. And he's sober and he's experiencing much of heaven, rocketing in the fourth dimension of existence. He's like emotionally sober. He's spiritually sober. He's at a different deal. And it's a deal so different. It's different than everybody else I've seen in AA. I see maybe 1 in 100 have that deal going on. It's so obvious that it stands out. It stands out. And so I'm watching this guy, Al Kennedy. He's one of those guys. He has that deal. And he's talking. And he walks. Now, I want you to put yourself in my shoes. I'm not making this crap up. That's what's amazing about it. This is like a true story. He finishes the meeting. They all clap and everything. He walks out of the room. He had like 30 years or something. And I say to my sponsor, I turn to him and I say to my sponsor this. I want you to imagine this. I say, that guy was great, because he really was. He was great. He was uplifting. I felt, you know, one of these guys should feel good after me. I said, man, if I could only hang out with him, I'd be okay. And my sponsor turns to me, and this is what my sponsor says. It was Bob Sullivan, the first sponsor. He says, yeah, you know, he's dying. Did you hear what I just said? He said, he's dying. And so I say to him, like I didn't even hear him, I said, no, I'm talking about the guy who just did the meeting. I mean, I can't, you know, this guy just did a meeting. He just did an AA meeting. You know, I'm looking at him. He's fantastic. He's helping people and everything. He didn't say anything about dying. He didn't say, I'm dying of cancer. He says, he just did the meeting. Then he walked off, and that was the end of that. And he says, he's dying. I said, no, I'm talking about the guy who just did the meeting. He says, Russ, he's dying. I said, what do you mean? He didn't say anything about dying. He says, I know. I said, no, he didn't mention a word. He was just helping people. He's just like a regular. He says, I know. He says, Russ, he's got cancer. He's got 3-4 months left to live. I said, what are you talking about? What are you talking about? I said, Russ, he's dying of cancer. 3 months later, he was dead. If you saw that happen, what would you think? I mean, I couldn't even wrap my mind. I mean, I have a hangnail that's good for 15 meetings and a banana. You know what I mean? I can't, you know, what would you? Now, listen to me. When you're surrounded by people like that, and I was one of these guys, I don't know what, I thought everybody saw the stuff I saw in AA. Now, I now realize that just like every AA meeting, there are people that are interested in that stuff. They want what we have, and there are people that don't want what we have. There are people just waiting and said, when's this guy going to shut up? I got to get out of here because, you know, there's a TV program on. And there are people just transfixed. I want this guy to go on for another hour. You know? There are two different groups in AA. There are the groups of people that will stay in a room for 15 hours just to listen to one guy because they want what he has. And there are groups saying, well, you know, this guy's going to go 5 minutes over. You understand what I'm saying? There's two types of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why there's a separation of the men from the boys. There are people that want this more than anything else. They want what we have. They're willing to go to anything. And there are people that don't want what we have. They're not willing to go to anything. They're not even willing to sit through a meeting and turn their phone off. Because something might call them from the outside that's more important than this stuff. And I thought everybody was seeing what I saw with Al Kennedy. Just like this guy probably thought everybody would see what he saw when he says, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing it. And I saw this guy. And, you know, I wanted what Bob Sullivan had. It doesn't bother me like it bothers you. I wanted what Joe Snyder had. You're upset because you're upsettable, Russ. I wanted what Al Kennedy had. I focused on these guys, hung around these guys. I didn't even know what they had. I didn't even know how to get it. I didn't know anything about it, but I knew they had it. And I was going to hang around them to try to figure out how to get that deal. While other people were sucking their thumbs, feeling sorry for themselves. And I found out by hanging around these guys that was all about God. It was all about faith in God. It was all about that deal. They knew all that stuff. They didn't put God down. They didn't put religious down. They didn't put religious people down. It was all about. So you see, to me, the second step, ultimately, is not even about God. You know, it isn't even about what it's really. What do you want for the rest of your life? It's what do you want? You really want to go for the next 30 years or 40 years on deathbed and say, I think I missed the whole thing because I was a thumb-sucking crybaby? Or do you want that rocket ship? To me, it's all about wanting the rocket ship ride. It's all about what you want. Because nobody's going to force you to do anything. There are consequences to every choice you make, you know? You know, people come into Alcoholics Anonymous not because they want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, because they want to stop drinking. They don't come here because they want to be. They come here because they want to stop drinking. Once you stop drinking, then you got to decide. Do you want to be yelling and screaming about the world and your wife or your husband or stuff like that and feeling sorry for yourself for the next 30, 40 years and white-knuckling this thing and thinking that sobriety is all about not drinking and picking up a chip at the end of the year while you're still yelling, screaming, feeling sorry for yourself? Or do you want what Al Kennedy had? Do you want what Joe Snyder had? Do you want what, you know, Bob Sullivan? Do you want what they had? You know, you're the one who makes that decision. So, you know, stop worrying about the guys. Start being what we need to think about is what they say in the big book. See that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you in Calvary. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him out. You can't manage your life. You can't find him. You know, God couldn't win a few years. Do you want what they're promising you here in the big book? Because well, they say if you do what they did, you're going to get it. Rarely have I seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed their path. If you think you're going to hang on to your old ideas and do it your way and be defiant and turn your thumb up on the God thing and somehow you're going to get the rocket ship ride anyway, I can tell you, I've been around for 32 years, you're sorely mistaken. All you're going to get is dry sobriety, running around looking for a guy, looking for a gal, looking to get laid, looking for a car, looking for this, looking for that, and when you don't have it, feeling sorry for yourself and sucking your thumb. That's what you're going to get in here. And you may stay sober, but you're going to live a life of quiet desperation. But if you want what that first guy had, remember what he said? I've been given the greatest thing. The greatest thing. Lifted from the alcohol scrap heap, you know, to a relation where I can help, where I can do God's work and help other people. If you want that deal, what these guys had, if you listen to what they have, then all of a sudden you open up and you become open-minded to the deal. That's what got me open-minded, because I wanted what they had. And so I was willing to listen, even though I didn't understand God, and who understands God? And even though I didn't know, and even though there's a little bit in me, because I'm an alcoholic, where I prefer not to go that way, I really would prefer to think that, you know, the answer to my life is a Camaro and a blonde. You know what I mean? Because I'm here triggered that. I wanted what they had, and what they had was their central fact in their life was God. So I followed them, and I followed their way. And I'll tell you something, the man or woman you'll be in the next 5 years will depend upon the people you hang out with and the book you read. And the books you read will depend upon who you hang out with. And that's the bottom line. It's going to be who you, you know, it's like the old, what your mother told you is true. You lie down with dogs, you get up with fleas. Guys, you want to hang around with guys that all they're going to talk about is baseball and broads. That's what your life is going to be about, baseball and broads. And you're not going to get anything. You want to hang out around with guys that are going to talk about other things, get involved in other things, whether it's Bible study, whatever it is, whatever the deal is, whatever they were involved in, it's going to be a whole different deal for you. So that's the decision you're going to have to ultimately make. Next week we'll talk about step 3. Thank you. That's your job.
I use it all the time.
Well, I used to tell a book, I said, what do you think? What do you think? And of course we'd say something, nah, I can't be right.
My son and I have an inside joke now. He says, Dad, you're upset because you're upset about it. And I